Sure.
Yeah. Going. Hanging in there.
What's that thing again? And then we'll do this and then we'll continue with this in a moment.
Yes, Myers.
Are we getting ready for the anime?
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Somewhere. K. Crystal K.
Yes.
KKK.
Miller, Montana.
Okay, we're going to take a break here and we'll come back to this one. Montana?
Thank you.
Saw Gilson last night.
Yeah, I got our email.
And you got all the paperwork is done.
Nice.
Right? So that's good, right? Okay, so let's get started. We'll hand back the rest of the exams after we get going a little bit when some other people come back in. But we have a special guest here today, Dr. Brent Creswell from STEM College of STEM, or Department of STEM College of Education. And he's going to take it away and tell you about something exciting that you can do.
Thank you. To help explain why I'm here, I want to focus your attention on a picture up front. So in the College of Education, I have several roles, and one of them is I teach pre-service teachers how to teach science. And so I have a group of elementary education majors. Right now, they're out of schools learning kind of practical, technical side of teaching. When they come back, we're going to do a lesson about relationships in ecosystems. And I don't know what you know about certain ecosystems, but there's an ecosystem where there is a caterpillar, and that caterpillar is very attractive to a species of wasp called caterpillar wasp. And I don't know what kind of relationships and things you study in this class or in other biology classes, but the wasp attacks the caterpillar and the female wasp injects its larva into the caterpillar. And the larva excrete chemicals that basically take over the brain, therefore the physiology. I thought that would be relevant to you guys. Physiology of the caterpillar. And so the larvae start to grow inside the caterpillar and take up the nutrients, eventually destroying the caterpillar, who unwittingly protects the larvae until they're large enough to escape out of its body, which is, if you want to see, there's a great National Geographic video of the grossness of that. I don't know kind of things you enjoy watching, but... So what's this have to do with why I'm here? Because I want students in our schools to learn about this. I want them to be excited about science. I want them to realize that science is a great pathway into a career for them. And when I talk to elementary education majors, they in general don't like science. And so if they had their druthers, most of them would not teach science in elementary schools. In fact, most of our elementary schools, I don't know what your experience was, but most of our elementary schools, there's not a lot of good science teaching going on. Any idea why our elementary education majors, when I ask them, why don't you like science, what the number one answer they give to me is? It's hard. Yes, absolutely hard. The number one reason that they give me, which is really discouraging to me, is they had terrible teachers who made science boring and uninteresting to them. And that's really disappointing because I love science. I'm sure if you're here, probably most of you love science. And to have teachers, to have students who become teachers who don't love science is very discouraging. So I want to see that change. I want people in schools that care about science, that understand science, and generally relate to their thinking. It's hard. Most of the elementary ed majors don't know science really well. And so we need to change that. And we need people to get into science teaching that really care about and understand science. And so I'm here to pitch to you an idea that maybe as a career pathway for you, science teaching could be a good option for you. I want to ask you one other question. How many of you are in this field, this major that you're in, partly because of some teacher in school that inspired you? Okay, if you look around, probably 50-60% of you. And that's not unusual, right? So if you think about the role that teachers have in kids' lives, how many people are inspired to go into what they do, what they want to do because of teachers, they really have an impact. And there aren't a lot of fields you can say that for. I was a high school teacher for 15 years. I've been out of the classroom, K-12 classroom, for 12 years, and I still get emails from former students saying, hey, I thank you for what you did. You inspired me, or you pushed me, or a student a couple weeks ago said, you're the one person who taught me how to think for myself. And I really appreciate that. That's helped me a lot in life. And so, you know, there are not a lot of careers where you get that kind of feedback and you have that kind of impact. And so teaching is that kind of career for you. So I just want to really quickly tell you about the program that we have that probably is most relevant to you. We have two pathways into teaching in our STEM education department. We have an undergraduate pathway, and I think most of you are seniors. Am I correct about that? Juniors, late juniors, seniors. You know, STEM Plus, our undergraduate pathway, is still an option if you're a junior. But if you're a senior, then the pathway that's most kind of relevant to you is it's going through a transition, so we're going to soon be calling it the MAT in Secondary STEM Education. And so what's really cool about this is, you know, if you're thinking about graduate school, most graduate master's programs are at least 2 years in the sciences. Our MAT program is a one-year, really two semesters, program that gives you a master's degree and initial certification to teach in the state of Kentucky. And the importance of that is, in Kentucky, if you go into teaching with a master's degree, then you start at a higher rank. Kentucky has three ranks, rank three, which is the lowest, rank two, which is what this program gives you, and so you start out at a higher pay grade. So even though the program costs you money, again, graduate program, you make that up by the increased pay that you start at and the fact that you'll be making that every year from the beginning of your career on. And so it's a wonderful pathway. It's a really compact program. We have the most compact master's program for initial certification in the state, and I think one of the most compact in the country. It's 31 credits, maybe one or two classes in summer as electives, and then two semesters, some methods course, some other education courses. We put you in schools. You get chances to work in public schools here in Lexington and the surrounding area. And then maybe you graduate. You've got teaching certification. You go out rank two. You're set to go. And one other thing I kind of pitch this to you, because it's hard. You know, I'm sure people have seen the news. If you're aware of what's going on in the news, education's having a tough time right now, thanks to, as usual, politicians screwing the education system up. But I think that's going to swing. And so, you know, why would you still want to consider it with what's going on? I've been here 5 years. I average about 10 people from our program graduating per year. And so that's 50 people, and every one of them has got a job right out of the park. So we have 100% placement rate in positions. And so it's not only a rewarding career, but it's a career where there's fairly good job opportunities, and there's obviously great security once you've got tenure in school. So it's a good program. We have our website, is because we're changing the program over. You know, the website is undergoing some revisions. So if you're interested in this, I'll leave some cards. Dr. Cooper can hand them to you. You can call or email me directly. But just, you know, here's the top quote is a student who just left our program last year. He's at Frederick Douglass High School here in Lexington. And I talked about what a great experience he had in the program. We really try to make it an innovative program, get you in schools, get you experiences working with industry and university researchers, and really prepare you to be in a dynamic science teacher. So that 10 years from now, when I interview students or talk to people, they say, hey, I had a great experience learning science in school. You can make that difference. So, thank you for the time here. Thank you very much, Dr. Cooper, for bringing me over here. Does anybody have any questions about the program? What's involved? Pathways to teaching? What's going on in the state?
And we had a student in here, what was it, last year? Amanda?
Amanda.
A year ago.
Yep, yep.
Amanda. And she went through the program. She was an animal physiology student, great student. And we went up to visit her, what was it, last semester, I think, right?
I went up once and you went up once. Yep, yep.
And she's up by Amos, Kentucky, just above Shelbyville. And that school, you kind of think about, it's very rural, but they actually have a connection with Bellarmine. And their students are actually going to Bellarmine, taking college classes and then coming back. So she had, you know, really had to up her ante about teaching science, because here they're taking courses at Bellarmine University. And there was a nice grant they had, I guess, with Bellarmine.
Yeah.
They all got laptops. Can you imagine that? That's great for high school kids. And then here they're taking their calculus or their biology or whatever it is. And then she had, you know, they have study time at school, too. So good connections as well. I mean, even if it might, you might think it's rural, but, you know, a lot of schools connect in. And we try to get out there a lot as well.
Yeah, and schools like that are really innovative. It's cool. They have a maker space there, so kids go in and work on, you know, do-it-yourself projects. And so it's really cool what's happening in schools. And if you're an innovative person, you can go in and continue to make our schools better and more innovative places to be. It's pretty cool. So, again, thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I got my cards here.
So we'll have cards up here you can email. Wonderful.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cooper.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
It's been great. And if you want to volunteer out and helping teaching, remember, we still go out to schools all the time. So fun to do. All right, some of you maybe didn't pick up your test yet. Just raise your hand real fast, and I'll try to go around as quickly as I can. Something. Let's go over the test real fast. And if you're comparing with your neighbors right now on anything, you might realize there were two different exams. The same questions, but the answers were varied on A, B, and C, and D. All right. And so you have to kind of watch out what you're looking at. Scantron should be back probably when this class is finished, and then I can start uploading them into the system. So you had 106 points, right? So that's good. So a bonus, hopefully. What I just graded and what I have online are the bonus points out of the 10, right, that we had at the back. It was actually open, not really bonus, open response questions. There's 10 points there on the very last page, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. So that's where those on the what's posted on the grades in Canvas. Let's quickly kind of go through this because this is important and to make sure that we understand these because why? We have a final exam, which is comprehensive. So hypothalamic neurons release into the capillaries. So hypothalamic, that's the key right here, neurons, right? What do they release into, right? ADH and oxytocin, right? So it might be a different answer depending on which question you, which test you have. But basically, antidiuretic and oxytocin. Which of the following endocrine glands is a modified sympathetic ganglion? Adrenal medulla, right? Some really easy ones. Do you recognize some of these questions? Yes, the quiz. It's important to get back your quizzes and to go over quizzes. Which of the following is a physiological example of positive feedback? We talked about some of these, but I tried to emphasize the points here. Positive feedback, we have to think about, usually we're thinking about right away oxytocin and birthing, right? But notice this key word here called after parturition. Fetus is delivered. So after delivery, right? So you don't have any more stretching of the uterus. So you're not having the positive feedback. But the other positive feedback is suckling with oxytocin. We talked about the oxytocin aspect. Okay, now somebody asked me during the exam for a calculator to calculate this one. But do we remember this was what we went over? We kind of made the point in the lab when we were going over those to remember how to calculate mean arterial pressure. So diastolic, right? What's the equation? Systolic minus diastolic, right? So if I tried to make this easy, 140 minus 50 equals 90. What's one third of 90? That's where somebody asked me for a calculator. Want to strangle them, but it's okay. So that is 30, right? And then what was diastolic again? 50. So 50 plus 30 equals 80. Not so bad. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, mention things. Is that better? Zoom in? Oh. Let's see if this thing will zoom in. Oh, yeah, maybe here. Now we refocus. Okay. Is that better? Can you see it? We need glasses. Can you see it in the back? Is it too hard to see? Should I shut the lights down more?
Well, they won't let me cut that one down.
There you go. Is that even better? You can also scoot up. You know, lots of seats. We don't charge you for the front row. Okay? All right. So steroid hormones are derived from... cholesterol. This is group effort here. All right, the pressure in the left ventricle is greatest during which phase of the cardiac cycle? Blood can only go from what? Low pressure to high pressure, right? So can blood go from the low, you know, a higher pressure, I mean, a lower pressure into a higher pressure, like we want to get it into the aorta, right? So it has to go into the aorta. So that tells you already the left ventricle has to have higher pressure than the aorta, for example, right? So when does this happen? R into the pulmonary artery. But if you just want to think about the aorta. So it has to happen during ventricular ejection, right? It has to have higher pressure in the ventricle to get pressure into the aorta or pulmonary artery. And I don't know how many people miss different questions yet because I don't have the scantrons back yet. So I don't know if you missed these or not. Regulation of resistance of blood vessels is under the control of... So best answers, you know. Smooth muscle contraction is important, right? And autonomic nervous system to regulate smooth muscle contraction, right? So that one. Now, this one we kind of made a point of in the lab for every four sections with my 9 hours of straight on Monday and 3 hours on that Wednesday involved. We talked about the pacemaker potential, slow depolarization, right? And I made a point about the difference between ventricular muscle action potential and pacemaker potential. And we talked about that rise, that funny sodium channel, the F sodium channel, and then the calcium channels. Different than the ventricular pacemaker. Okay. And arthropod muscle, if you remember back when we talked about skeletal muscle, They're very unusual because they can have an inhibitory as well as excitatory. They can be graded. All kinds of neat things. And if they have inhibitory, well, they can have inhibitory. They have multiple synapses, you know, multiple spots. That's why it's graded, we talked about. And they can be innervated by multiple neurons. So it's really, you know, everything right there for arthropod muscles, like your favorite animal, which is crayfish. All right, I noticed when it was going around the exam, some people actually still missed this question, and they shouldn't have missed this because it was on the quiz that we had. Gonadotropin-releasing hormone, the R, where does that come from? Hypothalamus. So it's going to work on what? Anterior pituitary, right. All right, so whoever that was that missed that one, I want to strangle you because you had a quiz on that. Okay, if one injected in their body glucocorticoids, which kind of includes what? What would be a glucocorticoid, for example? Cortisol, right. Every day for a period of months, what would likely be the scenario? Well, if the body is sensing this exogenous glucocorticoids, cortisol, for example, and I tried to help out the adrenal gland cortex to get you, you know, thinking about this, may reduce the endogenous production and release of cortisol, right? Because it thinks it's getting too much already. And we mentioned about that stress. If you're injecting these compounds and all of a sudden you come off cold turkey, you can't make enough cortisol to handle that kind of stressor. It's kind of like some of the drugs that people take with antipsychotics as well, or antidepressant medications. Very dangerous to come off these things cold turkey. Okay. Now this goes back to the heart muscle. So the plateau phase of the cardiac muscle potential in the ventricular muscle, keywords, ventricular muscle, is due to what?
Calcium.
Elevated calcium, exactly. Frank Starling principle. Now you might think that all of these are somewhat related, right? Because this can put the back pressure on the ventricle stretches and contracts, right? So they're all kind of related. Anything with the circulatory system, basically, you can think of some way it's related. But what's the best answer here? Yeah, right. Distensibility, ventricular muscle contraction, right? Really? Because your heart could be small, your heart could be large. Stroke volume varies. But, yeah. But the point is that, you know, read all those questions. What was the last name again? Oh, you didn't get yours? Did you get yours?
Yeah, I did. I just have one more
call. Oh, you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay, what's the question? Question.
I thought one of the practice exam questions had the other answer.
It also had in the test bank, it said stroke volume versus pressure was the
first
answer.
Pressure.
Yeah.
Did it have this answer, though?
No.
But it said, like, that. But, like, there was one that was, like, it relates to stroke volume.
It does relate to stroke volume. But you can also have better questions, better answers, right? I know. So this, we'll work with this in case you're like on a borderline grade or something, and if one question is going to make a difference, definitely come back, circle that one, save, talk later.
What is
distensibility? Distensibility. The Wincastle effect. Okay. So one of the people asked questions about on the old exam. There were, which hormone can go in and bind to cytoplasmic receptors? And on one old exam, it was testosterone. And then on the next exam, it didn't have testosterone, but it had estrogen. Right? See what I mean? So this is where I want you to know this concepts a little bit. But we can come back. I didn't mean to make this tricky, or I thought I made it kind of accessible, extra, you know, drawing some of the points. But if this is a contentious problem, we can look at that. Okay, elephantitis, we showed those gross pictures in the lab. What was that due to? You know, blockage of the lymphatic system, right? Now I tried to make a point about the next one. the invertebrates, can they control their arterial blood flow to their GI tract, to the other parts of their body, right? We showed those nice pictures of your favorite animal, but also of a crab, and that they can direct blood flow, so it's not, you know, the point was open circulatory systems, it's not just blood dumping out in the body, but they can actually direct blood flow. So they can have arteries that from the heart that direct blood flow to particular regions in their body, right? So we made a little point about that. Okay, so which one is the least porous? Porous is, you know, got holes in it, right? Holes. So least porous. So if it has the least porous, which is one the most porous? That was on an old quiz or exam.
Sinusoidal,
right? Because those are the ones in the bone marrow that allow red blood cells in. So the least one was the continuous, right? Like skeletal muscle, something like that. Okay. So follicular phase, remember that's the follicle, right? And we're not talking about the regular menstrual cycle and not pregnancy. So this follicular phase, which hormone?
Estrogen,
right. Okay. Body part, this was like a gimme, makes up for maybe the more harder ones. All right. Body part, biggest homunculus region is face. Okay, great. Now, if face wasn't there, we might, you know, have to think about something else, right? That could be a problem. If the face wasn't there, and maybe we could put, you know, fingers, right? The index finger, for example, or something like that, right? So you could just switch these around, you know, easily, right? What I'm saying is, on the final exam, you might see a similar question, but with different answers. Get the idea? Okay, so the topic. Okay, some people are really stressed over this one during the exam. A semicircular canal, so let's go through the three main things on the inner ear. Semicircular canals, utricula sacculus is the second one, and the cochlea is the third. What does the snail-like structure do, the cochlea?
Hearing.
What do the utriculus and sacculus do?
Static
position, right. So the semicircular canals are for equilibrium. All right, so this is the way you can go through these kind of things to think about. Now, some stressed out with this, but we talked about this, you know, 0, 180, and we actually went through this in class. But so let's just go through this real fast. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4. 1, 2, 3, 4, right? 4. 4 minus 4 is 0. Let's go through this one. 1, 2, 3, 4. 4. 1, 2. 2. 4 minus 2 is plus 2. So this is lead 1, and it's 0. Oh my gosh. So we have to draw a 90 degree angle through 0. Okay, so that's 90 degrees. Now we have a plus 2 on lead 3. Lead 3. Plus 2. 1, 2. 90 degree angle. Well, we go to the point of origin and draw that line. Well, I tried to make it easy. I thought I would not make it hard for you, but maybe that confused you. I don't know. So what is this? This is 0. That's right. Right. Okay. Are we good? 90. Right. 90. Didn't mean to confuse you. So if we change this to, let's just change this to 2, for example, here. What would happen if we put that to 2? This would be plus 2, right? If we change that, if that only went down to 2. So we would go 1, 2, and draw a 90-degree angle through there. And then we would have an arrow going down pretty much with lead 2. So what does lead 2? If you divide this up into 3 components of 180 divided by 3 is what? 180 divided by 3?
60.
So that would be 60 degrees, right? So just kind of think of that general point. So if it was less, then, you know, it'd be some, if it was in between those two, it could be 30. All right, so not too crazy. Okay, developmental structures for the uterus and fallopian tubes. This male, female?
Malarian.
Yes, female malarian ducts, right? So this was switched around on different exams. If it was the vas deferens and testes for males, what would it be?
Wolferin
ducts, right? And so think of the Wolf on Wall Street, male or wolf, you know, aggressive. Maybe that would help you somehow. Okay, so this was something that we emphasized to in the lab on the next one, the PR interval, right? P, QRS, T wave, right? So here's the point that we get to the AV node. Now, I bolded this or tried to reemphasize, get to. Remember, we talked about this is through the AV node, right? Because the AV node generally slows down electrical conduction. That PR interval is really to the AV, but through the AV node, because R is what? The ventricular muscle contraction, right? The electrical depolarization of the ventricle, QRS, right? So it has to go through the AV node. And the AV node is making up the major part of that time because that's where it's delayed, right? And your sympathetic system can speed that up. So this is how you can actually get a faster electrical conduction. So it's not just to it, it's through it. So it's got to be false in that sense. Now, I didn't mean to trick you. I just tried, and hopefully I meant that, you know, we emphasized that in the lab. But I know there was a lot of information, tremendous amount of information on the test, horrible amount. Okay, boatfish and rattlesnake muscle, hopefully everybody got that one. It's related to how fast you can get the calcium back down so you can contract again. How do you get calcium down in a muscle fiber? Very good ability to pump calcium into the cytoplasm, sarcoplasmic reticulum. Remember we talked about lots of pumps on the SR so it can pump that calcium back in so it can relax so it can contract again. In regards to taste perception, I try to emphasize this in the lab that day, that there's all these different ways. It's not just one way. It's not just ion channels, not just second messengers, not just blocking, not just the depolarization. But if you read through all these, this is like encompassing everything. Some of the chemicals bind to ligand-gated receptors, some that are ion channels and work through second messengers, while others bind to ion channels, alter the ion flux. So this is the most comprehensive answer that you could get on that one. Okay, pain. Caitlin, get this one? Yes. Pain. Anybody working in pain? But we talked about pain, and we talked about this in the lab, that this is kind of important because of the opioid crisis that we have going on. And this was, what does this neuron normally release? What does this big neuron normally release? What kind of, what are we talking about? Analgesic type, endogenous?
Opioids,
endorphins, right? Things like that. So the receptors have to be on D, right? The receptors, the opioid receptors, in big print, receptors. And it releases substance P, and then the receptors for substance P would be on E, right? D, right? The opioid receptors. Okay. Now, I think I saw somebody marking this on the test that was wrong, and I was like, oh my gosh, okay. So this is myosin, right? This is the actin, and you see that they're overlapping, but when they overlap too much, right, they start to interfere with each other, and you're having fewer sites. So this is fewer sites, so that's not good. This is overlapping, so there's fewer sites there, so that's not good. This doesn't have practically any sites overlapping, so that's not good. Process of elimination. You know, we got end up with B, right? Okay. Our wonderful leech ganglion that we talked about. What did we talk about the leech ganglion? Great stuff, like the beginning of understanding regeneration repair, that they could record from single cells, that actually that was the first time that they understood what glia actually do in on neurons, because they measured, as we mentioned, the intracellular electrodes in the glial packet, and they could stimulate the neuron and they could see that depolarization of the glia. So this was actually, as we mentioned in class, the one of the first recordings of physiology in glial cells for their function, to buffer the potassium around neurons that are active. But hopefully if you read through this, you'd say, oh yeah, hey, that's pretty cool, it's everything we talked about. And this is, there were only a few questions on the behavior chapter, but this one we kind of spent a good amount of time on. D? Down here? This one?
Yeah.
This is, the actin's overlapping quite a bit, right? And then this one is interfering with the other actin. You're losing the number of sites that you're binding. So this is two. If you look back at that curve that we had for length, of the sarcomere, right? And you had tension development. Remember we had kind of that curve that went up and it was plateaus for a bit and then it drops back down, right? If we're contracting so much, we're down here. So D would be in this region. C is up here in this region. B is in this region. This is that region. Okay?
Yeah. There were like certain animals, only certain animals that could do the overlap and they had like maximum contractibility or something. I don't know. That's what I thought of.
Oh, I see what you mean. They have, not for the tension development, they have super contracting muscles that the actin can actually go through to make them really short, you know, but make the sarcomere really short, but it's not, but it does, it decreases the tension. Right? It's just that they can have a really short sarcomere, because they can actually have holes. We mentioned in the barnacles, they can actually have holes in here where the actin can go through just to have super shortening. All right, didn't mean to confuse you. Hold that one, make a big question on that one in case it's a grade breaker.
So I remember that one slide where it was like, talked about tension is like a simple line for the CH zone, like, and stuff. And like it kept going short where it was overlapping where it's good now. Like it's
okay.
No overlap, then it would go kind of, and it would like really overlap. So.
All right, let's find it. Let's find it. It's always good to find out where they are.
It was similar looking to that.
Good point. Let's find muscle. If we drew maybe the actin up on top or the myosin interactions here, right?
Yeah.
Like now we don't have these interacting or something like that.
Yeah.
Right.
I think I just kind of assumed that it was like
they could still bind because it looked like
it could.
It was just on the M line and not overlapping of the bias.
Okay. All right. Well, save it. You know, grade breaking things. I'm not total meanie. Okay. Let's keep going on this real fast. My God, time goes flying. I saw some people circle visual system here. I wanted to strangle you, but anyways. Frontal cortex, right? Hopefully you would see that, and that was on old exams, that the frontal cortex is the greater part. Taste, remember the hot tamales, the red hots? What was all that about, right? You smell better, you taste through smell, and we mentioned about 80% of that, right? Of what you think you taste, you actually smell. Depolarization of the T-tubule, so we're talking about skeletal muscle, probably. Alterations of the dihydropyridine receptor causes mechanical gated calcium channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum to do what? Open. So right away you can say close. Close is off. Bind is off. Now we're on the opening. Leading to loading up of cytoplasmic calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum? No, right? It's coming out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Only answer left makes sense. Okay, so I know this was, you know, giving you a little word problem, hopefully, but you worked through it, maybe drew a diagram, and the only answer that's going to make sense here is that the virus is taken up in the nerve terminal and then transported up to the cell body, right? So the virus is taken up in the acetylcholine transporter, presynaptic nerve terminal, transported to the retrograde direction to the cell bodies. And I think all of the questions on this test, on this part, were all from an old exam that's on the test bank. I told you I was lazy. Okay. Smooth muscle, right? Smooth muscle. Extracellular and SR, so E, question?
I was just wondering, like, how are we supposed to know that it was taken out in the retrograde direction? Like, did we talk about anything like
that? No, but let's read the question. Postmortem biopsy, what does that mean? Someone died. The brain was taken and the person infected with the rabies virus. And was finding was that even though the rabid dog bite occurred in the leg, the cell bodies of the motor neurons contain the rabies virus. So motor neurons, rabies virus. Motor neurons, that's already acetylcholine, right? Also, particular areas of the brain, when examined, also showed the rabies virus in cell bodies, but predominantly in acetylcholine containing neurons. So the virus is taken up through glia mechanisms, and then glia transported the virus to the gap junctions. Are there gap junctions to neurons? No. The virus was taken up in all neurons, but selectively killed out all the neurons except for the ones containing acetylcholine. Well, that wouldn't make sense. You wouldn't have any brain tissue there left to really check. The glial cells selectively took up the virus and then die. And since glial cells are only around acetylcholine neurons, when the glial die, these neurons would be the only one. That, you know, glia is around all the cell types. So process of elimination with, you know, with kind of corny answers, you'd be only left with the one that kind of made sense. Right? So definitely, I mean, it's hard to make multiple choice questions, but, you know, you get to the point of, like, making the silliest answer possible so you wouldn't choose it. That's kind of where I was going. Okay. So which of the following creates a pressure reserve? Maintains mean pressure wave. What did we talk about? Windkessel effect, right? So the Windkessel is what type of artery? A large artery, right? So large arteries. Now the capillary beds, we talked about arterial side, venous side. What's responsible for the leak from the capillaries on the arterial side of the capillary?
Hydrostatic
pressure of the blood, right? Okay. Here comes our wonderful curve that we really needed to know. And this also was to help you with that other question if you were thinking about this, right? The injection fraction, the injection pressure. Look at this one. It's the highest up here, right? So it's really high with that systolic, the ventricular ejection. So what's happening here at B? Aorta's opening, and it says pressure. And it says left side of the heart, giving you all these things. Left side of the heart. This is the aortic pressure coming here. So the aorta opens, pushes blood into the aorta. Aorta is going up. Ventricles now dropping down in pressure. And then what's happened right here? Aortic valve closes, right? Opens, closes. And then with the other question was about the P wave. So where does P wave come in? Atrial depolarization. Well, you know, this is all ventricular stuff. So it had to, you know, be here right before the atria push blood into the ventricle. So that one is A. What to, aortic close. Now, these might be varied order on different exams. So, you know, watch out what you're... which exam you're looking at.
The aortic valve closes
at C. C, it opens at B, pushes blood into the aorta, closes at C here. Okay, so this was hopefully what we did in the lab. Fetal blood bypasses the pulmonary circuit, and I tried to make this helpful by structure located in the fetal intraatrial wall to try to give you a hint there. So intraatrial wall, well, we know that between, not the tricuspid, the ductus arteriosus was between the what? The pulmonary artery and the aorta, so not that one. It wasn't the pulmonary lunar, it wasn't the aortic semilunar. It was that foramen ovale that we mentioned in the lab with the fetus. So if we say pulmonary artery to the aorta, that's the ductus arteriosus, okay? All right, where are we? Okay, first heart sound, lub-dub. What does lub? Closing of the AV valve, so it has to do with AV valve dysfunction. Isotonic versus isometric. What does isometric mean? Same length. Isotonic means same tension, right? Same tension, like you're lifting the weights off the floor, and so it's the same weight. So, you know, muscle length changes, muscle tension continually increases, so the tension has to stay the same. So muscle tension continually increases. Muscle tension continually increases. Muscle tension, muscle length increases. Well, it's not going to increase if you're having contraction, right? So that doesn't make sense. So the only thing that makes sense here is A, right, on that. Muscle length remains the same, although muscle... through the muscle length may change. What did I just write? So the muscle length may change. The tension stays the same, right? But you're shortening it, so it's contraction. So you're lifting that weight up, and the weight's not changing. So the tension's the same. Okay. Single unit muscle fibers. We're thinking about smooth muscle, right? So single unit means they all function together as one group. Which ones was this? Have gut junctions and allow synchronized activity. Right, D. Which of the following characteristics do skeletal muscle and smooth muscle have in common? Well, remember, smooth muscle, you don't really see sarcomeres, so that's not there. Tropomyosin is moved from the myosin. That doesn't make sense. Calcium bound to protein calmodulin. That doesn't make sense. So we know that E has to can't be right either. So just by process of elimination, we're down to C. But C makes sense because we said there's still myosin and actin in there, and it's related to calcium, but we don't see a sarcomere. So, you know, that's this one. Oxytocin has action on which tissue? Not the anterior pituitary, not the adrenal cortex, not the liver, not the kidney, but mammary glands, right? Milk letdown. There's a big teapot on the other side of the sun rotating around. Anybody know that story? No? A Chinese proverb, you know, that he makes the comment that there's a teapot on the other side of the sun, but because Earth is over here, we never see it, but we know it's not true. Right. No, I'm just kind of kidding. So if you don't see it, I mean, there's no sarcomere, right? There's no banding pattern in smooth muscle.
I thought there is banding.
No, it still uses myosin and actin, but you don't see a sarcomere. It's not that nicely arrangement, right?
So where did the actin and myosin?
They're there, but they're kind of...
Where are they bound?
They still bind, and they still can work, but they might bind to the cell plasma membrane, right? But not as a sarcomere. Not as a nice sarcomere. And that was one of the key points in the table that we had with muscle. Right. Let's go to that then. Wherever that figure is. Oh, yeah. just to make sure we're all on the same thing. Okay, and we'll keep going on some of this over here. Okay, so this wonderful table, smooth muscle, visible banding pattern. No, for smooth muscle. Oh, that's not good. Different buttons. Okay. Non-striated, right? Got it?
I thought they still had them.
Right here at the table.
Yeah, I
don't. Okay, perfect. All right. So, let's go through this thing. Which of the following hormones is not released from the anterior pituitary? Anybody? ADH, antidiuretic hormone. Cortisol will increase the blood primarily due to which hormone? ACTH, right? Back to that endocrine chapter. It's disastrous. Here comes this same kind of table again that we were just talking about. Which label is best fit for slow oxidative twitch fibers? Slow oxidative? Slow means fatigue resistant, a lot of mitochondria. So you think, oh, well, it could be one of these, but fatigue resistant. Then we get, okay, you know, this one's the best answer right for that one. Septum of the ventricles to the ventricular muscle. So we have a heart. Let's do SA node to AV node down the bundle of His, and then to the Purkinje fibers, right? Purkinje fibers, there's that one. Decreased plasma. Now this one, I thought I was going to get to GI a little bit, or some of the endocrine stuff. So this one, you didn't get marked off. This one was a gimme. You got the 2 points on this one, okay? Because I gave everybody this one that's not going to be graded. So you just got it. I didn't take it away. Gave the 2 points. Why are we going to give this 2 points? Because this is going to be a learning lesson for me, because I made the exam too early. But then also, the question in here relates to what we're going to cover about GI system, so, and some vitamins. So let's pay attention to this, because we might see this again. So, but you might have worked this through, and so it could be kind of neat. So what does parathyroid hormone normally do? What does it do to calcium levels? Increases it. So doesn't this a head scratcher? Right, this is a head scratcher. You got an increase in parathyroid, but you got a decrease in plasma calcium. Wow, something's not right. Right? Because if you had a higher parathyroid, you would have higher calcium. So if you have hyperparathyroidism, and we didn't talk about these different types, that doesn't make sense. Hypoparathyroidism? Well, if you have hypo, that means less parathyroid. But we got an increase in parathyroid. So that doesn't really make sense. So even if this was a test question like on MCAT or some of the standardized exams, and you don't know the answer, go through the process of elimination and try to eliminate the ones that don't make sense. At least you get it down to something that might make sense. Calcitonin deficiency. Well, if you have no calcitonin, maybe that would increase the blood calcium levels, but would that cause an increase in parathyroid hormone? If you had extra calcium around, then your parathyroid would probably go down, right? So there's something odd about all this. So that doesn't really make sense. Now, we didn't talk about vitamin D, so this is why we didn't grade this exam. Vitamin D from the sunshine is very important for calcium absorption from your GI tract. If you do not have vitamin D, you're vitamin D deficient, you do not absorb calcium from your GI tract. So vitamin D is very important for getting calcium into your body. So vitamin D deficiency will keep calcium low in the blood. And what's that going to do to your body, your hormone response? It says, I don't have enough calcium. I better get parathyroid released to try to get calcium breaking down from bone so I can raise that calcium up because I'm not absorbing enough calcium. So this is the point about you would increase parathyroid hormone because your calcium is too low because you don't have vitamin D for absorption. But because we didn't cover that, but you get the idea of the process.
Just a question. Is the parathyroid hormone bring calcium in?
Parathyroid hormone can try to help with that too, calcium absorption, and help in reabsorption from the kidneys, but also bone breakdown and increase in calcium. It stimulates osteoclast,
okay.
The breaking down.
Why would it not be?
Because if you have low This is OB, primary hyperparathyroid. If you had a hyperparathyroid, you would have be raised calcium. Okay? Now this one, lots of wild answers with this one, these open response questions. Oh, it was interesting. Cell body. So I want you to kind of read questions and really, you know, highlight keywords, okay? Cell body, preganglionic, sympathetic, parasympathetic. So where does the sympathetic come from? Where does the parasympathetic come from? Well, from what we covered in the class. Now, if you answered some more other kind of questions related to other courses and other things, we would have looked at it. But in generally, sympathetic is which part generally did we talk about? Thoracic lumbar, right? Parasympathetic? Cranial sacral, right? But then that's not really enough. Some people just wrote spinal cord. But where does this really come from? The thoracic lumbar is a region, right? But then you have to mention spinal cord, right? Spinal cord. Okay, just not anywhere in your thoracic lumbar because you have ganglion in your thoracic lumbar too, right? Those ganglia that are outside of the spinal cord. So spinal cord. But then when we talk about spinal cord's a big piece of tissue. If we took a cross-section of the spinal cord, what do we have in here? We have our psychology test here, this butterfly. We're seeing butterflies, right? This is dorsal, this is ventral, this is the dorsal horn, this is the ventral horn. And I know we didn't cover some specifics in here, so if you said the ventral horn of the gray matter, then you got that okay for if you lynched which direction, where you were, thoracic, lumbar, cranial, sacral. But if you just said ventral horn, I don't know where you are anywhere in the spinal cord. You could be in the sympathetic or parasympathetic. It's not the dorsal horn. This is where sensory information comes in, right? But in reality, then, we didn't cover it in here, but really, the sympathetic ganglion for the cell body of the preganglion, it actually comes from this little region right here between the ventral horn and the dorsal horn. And if you were given an anatomy exam, like if you're in dental school or med school or PA school, they might ask you, where is this cross-section of the spinal cord taken? If you see a spot where you see like a little bump that comes out right there, like a little point right there, you will know that you're in the thoracic lumbar region. Okay? Because that's where the cell bodies are for your preganglionic sympathetic nervous system. So if you ever get that, they'd like to do that to you on anatomy exams and gross anatomy class and stuff like that. Okay, so, but if you just mentioned in the gray matter in a particular region, or if you said cranial sacral, like the beginning of where the cranial nerve comes from in the brainstem, the beginning of it, like where the cell body is for the vagal nerve, that would have been okay because it comes down the vagal nerve, right? Vagus on the heart, for example. So you got to be a little specific on these things. And I'm trying to get you ready. Ventral horn, but then where? Thoracic lumbar. Yep, right. You have to say where, like in the spinal cord. Because the ventral horn in the thorax or in the cranial sacral, on the sacral, those are different, right? Right. Okay, so, and we kind of give a lot of leeway here. So this question is receptor subtypes. It's not the neurotransmitters. It's the receptors. What we were really looking for was like alpha, beta up here, or you could write adrenergic, but then on the other side, people just wrote like acetylcholine. How many different receptor subtypes are in the acetylcholine that we've covered? You know, nicotinic and muscarinic. And this is parasympathetic, so what type of acetylcholine receptor are we talking about? Muscarinic. Okay. Good. Okay. We're almost there. And my God, we're so far behind. Okay, so cellular level mechanism, and people went wild with this one. But the key is cellular level, and what's the other key word here? Liver. Gross liver. Now, we got people asking, you know, writing questions about insulin and glucagon. Where does insulin come from? Pancreas. What type of cells? Beta cells. Where does glucagon come from?
Alpha cells
in the pancreas. Is the pancreas the liver? No. Okay, so we have to think about that. And so this is where people lost points because they forgot the liver is not the pancreas. And it's sympathetic, right? We're talking about sympathetic. So we could have lots of different answers here. But in class, we mentioned that it's really kind of neat because you have sympathetic drive directly on the liver. And that can stimulate the liver in ways. So that's epinephrine, directly sympathetic. Or you could have done another thing. You could have said the sympathetic, you know, stimulates glucagon release from the pancreas, and that the glucagon then worked on the liver. Or you might have even, I think we talked about some cortisol and, you know, stress hormones and maybe other ways. I tried to give as best points as I possibly could for it, you know, working on the liver. But we're talking about the liver now to increase glucose. So what's in the liver? What's stored in the liver? Glycogen. And we can... So what is happening in the cell, we're breaking down glycogen. That's glycogenolysis, right? Breaking down glycogen. But you can also, the liver, like an exercise, can take up lactate, and we can make new glucose by gluconeogenesis. New genesis. Okay, so if you kind of got anywhere close to this, we, you know, got you some points in there. Hopefully, maybe you missed one, but you got something. But you got something wrong about like the liver with glucagon and insulin or something being released from it. Okay, so this is the one that we talked about in class, and I gave you that kind of website that was kind of neat about what the spleen does. The spleen stores white blood cells, right? It's part of your lymph system. The spleen doesn't really just make antibodies, but your white blood cells or your fighting T cells could make antibodies. But as long as you got the general idea. So the spleen is an important part of the lymphatic system to help fight infection. You got those 2 points. Hopefully that was easy. Now this next question. Keywords. So I emphasize keywords, major keywords. Major artery, bleeding badly. Okay? So bleeding badly and major artery. So what is your cardiac output generally? What's a person's cardiac output? General. Adult. Human. You, right now. Cardiac output is heart rate times stroke volume, or heart rate, you know, 70 beats, stroke volume, generally. About five liters per minute, right? So, 5 liters per minute. What's your systolic pressure? About 120 over 70, right? So I just want you to kind of think through this. 120, maybe over 70, millimeters of mercury. 5 liters or 5.2 liters a minute, right? That means in 1 minute, just think, 1 minute, how much your heart pumps in a minute, right? So now I'm working on the lumber yard and my arm gets cut off on the saw. Major artery in the arm, not an arterial, major artery. My arm is gone. What's going to happen right here? It's like Mighty Python, right? It's squirting out blood. At how much blood is going every minute? 5 liters a minute. So what's happening within that minute? Initially, what's going to happen to your blood pressure? And what's going to sense it? Carotid sinuses, right? So what do those carotid sinuses tell the brain? It says, your blood pressure's dropped. I got to do something immediately. What's it going to do to raise blood pressure? Increase heart rate, right? Sympathetic. Increase heart rate, increase stroke volume. Boom, boom, boom. Faster, faster, faster. What's going to happen to the blood shooting out my arm? Within the next 30 seconds, right? It's going to go faster. And by a minute, how much blood is left in my body? None. Right, basically, right? So what's going to happen here to this person? So with these kind of values, major artery, non-arterial, you're not going to direct blood away from your heart, from your cut-off arm, right? That's not going to happen because you've got a major artery. Now, unless you put a tourniquet, but it doesn't ask you what you do with a cut for a major artery. It says what's happening homeostatically right here. So you're going to lose, you're going to, carotid sinus is going to detect that, trigger the sympathetic system, increase heart rate, increase stroke volume, make the bleeding worse, and now you die, right? And you're probably going to be dead within like a minute or two, right? That's about it. So you don't have any time to worry about kidneys with aldosterone, reabsorbing sodium, right? Because how much, what's your glomerular filtration rate about? Your GFR from your renal lab. What's your GFR? What do you remember? What was the number that you had? Your kidneys filter about 18 liters a day, right? About 18 liters. How much urine do you make a day on average? About 1.8 liters a day. Let's just think 1.8 liters. Let's just do 2,000 liters. Let's say you had a little coffee. So 2,000 liters, 2 liters, right? 2,000 milliliters, about 1.8 liters. So this is a day. All right, so let's take 2,000 divided by 24. What do we have here? Whoops. 2,000 divided by 24 equals 83 milliliters an hour. Let's divide that by 60. We get 1.38 milliliters a minute of urine production. Now, if we started to reabsorb some water out of there, are we going to raise blood pressure very much within a couple minutes? No, right? So it's not going to work. It's that kidneys are not going to work that fast to raise your blood pressure to solve your arterial bleed, right? But it could kick in, but you're going to be dead before that kicks in, right? So this is this kind of question has been asked on intro physiology exams in dental school, medical school, pharmacy, doesn't matter, whatever. You know, it's just an intro kind of exam question to try to make you think through some keywords. And you might get that type of question. So this is where we're going with that. Okay. Now, we don't have any more time. I'm out of time. Okay, but what are we going to do? We are going to... I will get those as fast as I can to you. But what I want to do on Thursday, in a little bit, we'll just begin it here, is go through respiratory. Now, there's a lot to cover in respiratory, but a lot of it is kind of gee-whizzy. But there's some really key points that we want to cover in respiratory. And those are important. But what do we have respiratory for? Why do we have lungs? Why do we need lungs? Any ideas? Get oxygen in. Something else for? Gas exchange, getting something out. CO2 out. Your lungs also serve a really important part about your immune system. When you sleep, that actually helps to with your immune system too. Lots of different things going on with your lungs. But when we talk about respiration in general then, for other animals, what do we need? A simple animal, like a little planaria, right? It's so small, you don't have a lot of tissue to diffuse through, so you can get gas exchange basically by diffusion, right, into a small animal. So think about that, small animals for diffusion. But as you start to build up a thicker body, you can't get diffusion into that tissue that's really big anymore, right? So then you have to develop something, some way, to get gas exchange down to the tissue where you have making ATP, right? And what do we need? We need oxygen. But you have that byproduct of CO2, so we've got to get that out. So we can't just rely on diffusion anymore when we start to get larger animals. So we got to think about developing some respiratory structure, either like in the insects, you begin to see a tracheal system going down, right down to the tissue. So these tracheal tubes, is like our lungs, basically bringing oxygen right on down to the muscle. So they have these tracheal tubes that actually branch into the muscle. That's pretty cool. And diffusion also plays a role. So just a little bit about diffusion that we should remember. Solubility of gases, back to chemistry, I know, purge, you want to purge it. Shooting me for the last test already. I know. But think about temperature and solubility of gas in distilled water. So if we raise the temperature, we just look at oxygen, what's happening to the solubility? It's dropping. So in an animal that's cold, you can have better solubility than in warm. So when you're exercising and temperature's going up, say, your solubility of gases drops, right? Because temperature. All right, so that's kind of interesting. I know this is a little blurry there, but salinity is a big factor too, because you have freshwater animals, you've got saltwater animals. And your body isn't fresh water, it's got salts in there too, right? So we've got some extra issues. So as we raise salinity at a given temperature, let's just say 20, what happens to the solubility? Decreases, right? You can't get as much oxygen into salt water as you can fresh water, for example. So now these fresh saltwater animals have something else to worry about. Would you expect greater hemoglobin, maybe, or greater ability of an isoform to pull in oxygen? You know, just things to think about like that. Then altitude. What about you if you wanted to take a break and you wanted to go to Colorado over the summer and you're going to go to Pikes Peak, right? Or Leadville, Colorado is the highest place in continental USA where people live around the year. And they have some special issues in Leadville, Colorado. Those people that live there have actually been studied quite a bit. As we increase altitude, what happens to barometric pressure? It drops, right? And we're going to think about the ambient oxygen level as you go to Mount Everest or wherever, right, or to Colorado. What happens to the ambient partial pressure of oxygen when you go up to high altitude? It drops. So we're going to see how that relates to alveolar oxygen levels. So remember, the concentration doesn't change. If you took a meter box and you put it at sea level and you measured the percent of oxygen, it's 21% about, right? If you took that same box and you went up to Mount Everest and you opened the box to get the gas exchange, what's the percent of oxygen up there? Still 21%, basically. So the percent doesn't change, but that barometric pressure changes. And that's where we have to think about this. So how you determine like the partial pressure of oxygen? It's that barometric pressure times the percent. And say oxygen is about 21%, or about 0.2%, right? So that's how you figure out that. But what if we add moisture to the air? That's going to take away some of that oxygen, the partial pressure. So in your lungs, for example, when you breathe in air at sea level, you're taking away some of that barometric pressure as well. So generally, most textbooks use 18. Sometimes it might be 20, you might see. So you subtract out, you want to measure the partial pressure of oxygen in your alveolar tract where you're going to have gas exchange to your blood. So you minus 18, and you get, this is the pressure pushing, if you want to think about it, pushing oxygen from your alveolar sac into your blood. Okay? This is like the pressure that, think about it that way. That might be the easiest way to think about it. Okay? So think about these things in relationship. What if you're at altitudes and you see those old movies, they're in the plane, they jump out of the plane, why are they carrying oxygen tanks? Or that the pilot, you know, the plane gets attacked or something like that, and the part of the plane comes off and they like can't breathe. Why are the pilots wearing an oxygen mask? Why are they wearing a mask, right? Because the barometric pressure is so low, they don't have enough pressure in the atmosphere to even push oxygen into their blood, right? So you might see some of those older movies where they'll wear, our skydivers that are very high, they'll have compressed oxygen. Or if you go to altitude, like to Mount Everest, some people do it without oxygen tanks. The problem is, as soon as there's a little storm, what happens when a storm hits? What happens to barometric pressure? It drops. So if there's no storm and they're climbing up to Mount Everest really quickly and then come back down, they don't hang out there very long, they might make it. But a lot of people die climbing Mount Everest because as soon as they climb up there, a little storm comes in that they can't predict very well. Barometric pressure drops. It's so low, they don't have enough pressure to even get oxygen into their blood and they die. And guess what they do with those people? Generally, they just leave them right there because that's kind of what they do, is they just leave the people dead on the mountain. That's part of, hey, wake up, Paul, you know. And so it's kind of interesting. There's lots of neat books written by physicians that have actually been on some of these excursions and talking about mountain conditioning and these issues like with barometric pressure. Okay, so Thursday it is, quickly, we're going to go for respiration. Next Monday, next Tuesday, what do we have in here? A quiz. What is going to be on that quiz? Respiratory and maybe a little bit of osmoregulation. Both PowerPoints are up there. We'll probably get to that point as we go along. Okay. If you didn't get your test and you want to get your test, come on up.